Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Today is one of those rare days where I'm going to have to play two songs to make my point. A couple of iconic songs. Here is the first one.
Ionic.
Alvin, hit me with some horns and some keyboards. Oh, hell yeah. What do you think of when you think about that song? What do you think about when you hear that music? There's only one thing to think of. That is the NBA. And the NBA is back. The NBA is back. Sort of. Kind of. If you squint really hard, it is. Because NBA teams in the bubble started to scrimmage yesterday. In other words, two teams wearing two different jerseys, playing against each other for the first time in more than 4 months. And it was the taste of what it's going to be like to play games without fans. I mean, it was kind of strange. It was really strange. It means we're going to have moments like this from before the Clippers Magic scrimmage.
Yeah, now please welcome the visiting team, the Orlando Magic.
Like, I'm not sure what's more surreal. The Orlando Magic being the visiting team in Orlando. The fact that nobody cheered. The fact that nobody was there to cheer them, or the fact that the public address announcer was actually asking the non-existent fans to welcome the Magic. All weird.
Now please welcome the visiting team, the Orlando Magic.
I would like all of you to welcome your visiting team, the Orlando Magic, in Orlando. Weird. No fans also means a lot of squeaking shoes, at least for now.
Clippers will come back down 4-0 with 8.5 to go in the first quarter. George pump pick on the right wing, drives down the right alley, bounce pass inside, and give Joakim Noah his first bucket as a Clipper. Position in the restricted area, and PG-13 found him on a beautiful dish inside. Welcome to the family, Joakim Noah.
That's something pretty interesting. That is Joakim Noah scoring for the Clippers. The Clippers in a scrimmage in Orlando. But even more important than that, did you hear that squeaking? I mean, that's an amazing bit of sound. And it means the guys will score nice buckets. Also, this is what we get in the bubble. Guys getting nice buckets like the way Lou Williams did right here. And once again, nobody there to respond.
And puts it in. Lou Williams so slippery offensively as he has a chance for three. 34 apiece with 5:20 to go here in the first half.
Just Lou doing Lou things. But it's weird. Look, it's not a criticism of the league or the setup. The court does look good. The video walls around the court are cool. It obviously just feels really weird and really different without the fans. Aaron Gordon had this to say.
It's really quiet. So you got to bring your own energy. You can hear everything that's being said on the floor. Kind of has a summer league type feel to it. And you really got to bring your own energy.
It's a good point. Now, Doc Rivers, one of the best coaches around and owner of one of the best coach voices around, did point out the upside. No fans means no coach voice for him because he's not going to have to yell over the noise.
Maybe I'll have a better voice by the end of this. I mean, who knows?
Maybe so. And I'm definitely not going to read too much into how the Clippers looked yesterday, or really how anybody looked yesterday. It was a reminder that being in great shape is one thing, but being in basketball shape is another thing. Playing NBA games, even an NBA scrimmage game, is a lot different than running on a treadmill or jogging through your neighborhood or even jumping on your Peloton. And it showed. Now, the one thing I do want to reference, the Clippers were doing some really interesting things with Paul George. And that's something you want to keep an eye on going forward because it's a reminder of how versatile this guy is on the offensive end. Keep that in mind. They were doing some really interesting things with him. Now, again, I'm not going to read too much into the first day of scrimmages, but having said that, I'll be damned if I'm just going to ignore what the Denver Nuggets did against the Washington Wizards. There has been a lot of buzz over the past few weeks about Denver big man Bol Bol and how much he has developed over the past year. Let me remind you as a refresher. Manute's son was expected to be a star at Oregon, but then he suffered a foot injury. Then he fell into the second round in last year's draft. Denver was able to acquire him, but he has not played in a single NBA game. But over the past few weeks, the hype surrounding him was building and building. The clips on Twitter have been really impressive. So the question was, how was he going to show up in Orlando? And then how would Denver use him? Would they slowly work him in, or were they going to throw him right into the fire? Check out this starting lineup for the Nuggets yesterday. The starting lineup for the Nuggets, starting at center, 6'11" from Duke, Mason Plumlee. Starting at power forward, 6'7" from Louisiana Tech, Paul Millsap. Starting at small forward, 7'2" from Oregon, Bol Bol. A 7'2"-3". Starting at guard, 6'8" from Syracuse, Jeremy Grant. And starting at guard, 7 feet tall from Serbia, Nikola Jokic. So that's right. What I'm saying is Paul Millsap at 6'7" was the smallest member of the starting lineup. You had a 7'2" guy at small forward, and you had a 7 foot tall first team all NBA center running the point. Let's get crazy. Let's get nuts. It's totally insane. And I loved it. If you thought that league was only about small ball, the Nuggets would like to have a word with you. Here comes tall ball. Here comes the long ball. And Bol Bol was incredible. Yeah, I know it's only a scrimmage in a bubble in Orlando, but he didn't just live up to all the advanced hype. My man smashed it. 16 points, 10 rebounds, 6 blocks, and he was doing stuff like this.
The number one field goal percentage team, over 50%, number 13.
Get out of here.
9'7" wingspan.
Oh, give me some. Give me some right now. Give it to me.
A block and then the three.
All right, so if you had trouble following that or you're not watching on CBS Sports Network, what that looked like was a block at one end of the court, dribble down, drain a three at the other. Impressive as hell. I mean, you're doing that in your first NBA action. I don't even care that it's a scrimmage. That was really impressive. I mean, that kind of thing is jaw-dropping when LeBron James does it, but it's mind-blowing when a 7'2" dude does that. As his coach, Michael Malone, said before the game, quote, "I can't teach 7'2". I can't teach a 7'9" wingspan. And I sure as hell can't teach a really soft touch all the way out to the NBA three-point line," end quote. No, sir. You can't teach any of that. Nor can you teach him showing up the way he did in his first NBA action and doing it against grown-ass men. He runs the court really well. He was starting the break, he was finishing on the move, and it was awesome. And the guy was a force on defense. 6 blocks. 6. Are you kidding me? Ask Michael Malone what he thought about it.
Yeah, it's his first game against NBA competition. And for him to go out there and get 16-10 with 6 blocks is great. You know, we put him in the middle of our zone, tried to funnel everything to him, let him block shots, did a really good job of that. I think he got tired as the game went on, which is to be expected. He played 32 minutes, which was a team high. But, you know, he's only going to get better. He did a lot of really good things out there. Proud of him.
I got to say, so am I. I'm proud of him, too. That was cool as hell. And, yes, again, it was only a scrimmage, and it was a game where the Nuggets did not have Jamal Murray, Will Barton, Torrey Craig, or Gary Harris. So they're probably not running that long ball lineup out there to start a playoff game, but that was so different. So wacky, man. So fun. Welcome back, basketball. Welcome to the show, Bol Bol. This guy's incredible.
Bol Bol.
Kelly McCrimmon is my guest. Kelly, it's great to have you on. Before we get into training camp, Kelly, and a return to hockey, how are you and everybody around you doing right now during this most unusual time, Kelly?
Well, definitely unusual times. I think we're at the point now where we're extremely excited. We're close. It looks like it's going to happen. So we're 3 days left of training camp. Then on Sunday, we travel to our hub, which will be in Edmonton. And, you know, really, when you look back to, I guess, March 11th, 12th, when we went on pause, no one had any idea what the future held in store. And it's really encouraging that we're at the point now where it looks like we're going to get to play some playoff hockey.
Right. Kelly McCrimmon, my guest. Kelly, I'm curious, given how long you've been around the game and going back to your days as a player when you were growing up and then at the University of Michigan, what has it been like for you to go through a hiatus like this where you've gone so long without hockey?
Well, it's uncharted waters. And for today's player, The training is year round, so it would have been the longest stretch that players around the NHL had ever been off the ice. So even though they would have had the opportunity to train, at their homes or wherever they could make arrangements, for them to be off the ice for this long would be really, really different for today's player. We had what they called phase two, where players could go back on the ice in small groups, which started early in June. So we were fortunate in Las Vegas that our players, almost to a man, stayed in town. So it gave us the opportunity to provide some ice and some training for the players during that period of time leading into training camp.
Kelly McCrimmon is my guest. I know that one of the things that you and the organization talked about with the players back in March was you wanted a team that gained a competitive advantage by how they handled the pause. I mean, can you make an argument that you could actually come out of this thing better than you went into it?
Well, I think in some respects, yes, Jim, based on health. So we, as the season went to pause, we're missing some key players out of our lineup that, you know, may or may not have been ready for playoffs if the original schedule was able to be played. So it's given us a chance to be completely healthy. I think in terms of the quality of play that I expect to see, it's given all teams a chance to get healthy. And ordinarily, when you play 82 regular season games and then 3 days later start your playoffs, teams are invariably carrying players into playoffs that have got bumps and bruises from the grind of a regular season. So this is going to be, I think, incredibly unique in that every team, for the most part, is going to be fully healthy, rested, and ready to go. So we talked about it with the players, again, about taking care of themselves and holding up their end of the bargain and, doing what we could to get a competitive advantage. So I've been really happy with what I've seen through camp. And, hopefully that positions us well for our team to play real well when we get to Edmonton.
We're talking to Kelly McCrimmon. So a lot to like in that. Because it is so different, though, the schedule had called for 13 days of training camp before heading to Edmonton on July 26th. Normally, when you have a training camp, then you have preseason, and that's followed by a long regular season. So how do you go about approaching training camp so you're ready to compete right away and hit the ground running?
Well, first of all, much smaller. So we had only 30 skaters at training camp a week. Mandated that would be the size of training camp. So, even by the fourth or fifth day, we were running one session of, roughly 25, 26 skaters. And, we were able to get right into systems, right into, kind of those systems that make up the foundation of your team. In our situation, again, a little bit unique in that Peter DeBoer, our head coach, came on board in January. So everything he was implementing at that time was on the fly. This has given him a real good opportunity to have his own training camp and to, really drill down on the different, systems that he wants our team to play. So that part has been, a little bit of a blessing in our situation.
In fact, Kelly, to that point, you had to make a tough decision and relieve Gerard Gallant of his duties as head coach. How tough a decision was that for you? And then what do you make of the job that Peter DeBoer has done since he took over?
Well, it was a really tough decision with Gerard. Of course, with the success our team has enjoyed as an expansion team, going to the Stanley Cup Finals in year one, we've had real good teams all 3 years. So that was difficult. Gerard was really well liked and well respected by the players. So, it was a difficult blow for them. And I think with respect to Peter, he's done a really good job. I think we were, 15-5 or something in the 20 games that he coached. Our team has played real well. We were playing real well going into the pause. And, obviously when you get to the playoffs, everybody's playing at a high level. It doesn't guarantee that it will translate, but we feel really good about our preparation and really good about the look of our team, the makeup of our team as we get ready to head into round one.
We're talking to Kelly McCrimmon, talking Vegas hockey. Speaking of the makeup of the team, Peyton Krebs was invited to training camp, which got a lot of people excited. He's only 19, but what's it say about him that you wanted him at camp, which is about preparing for high-stakes games?
Well, we drafted Peyton last June, and he at that time was coming off an Achilles injury, which prevented him from being part of our training camp last September. So this is the first opportunity for us to see him in a training camp setting, and you know, for him to come in and fit in as well as he has with, you know, 23 veteran NHL players, I think really speaks to, you know, his hockey sense and his level of ability. He's made a very good impression. He's made a very good impression, and, you know, he's got a bright future, and we're really, you know, encouraged with what we've seen here through training camp. I know that the coaches spoke very highly of him, and again, for our coaches, they'd never seen him in this setting before, so it was a chance for Peyton to make a first impression, and I think he's done a really good job of that.
Kelly, before you go, if you would, take me back a little bit. You and your brother Brad grew up in Plenty, Saskatchewan. So what was life like in Plenty, and what was it about hockey that you and Brad loved so much from the beginning?
You're right, Jim. That is where we grew up. So Plenty is a small farming community in Saskatchewan. And, you know, our dad farmed, or my grandpa farmed. And my dad was you know, a really good senior hockey player. So he played and coached senior hockey, you know, for many years. So for Brad and I, we were, you know, always at the rink, always with our dad. And, you know, hockey and farming were the two things that we knew the most about and had the biggest passion for. Brad and I were only a year apart in age, so of course we did everything together. And, you know, I appreciated at the time, but perhaps even more in hindsight, you know, the value system that that it gives you being, you know, in a small town, growing up on a farm. I really think it's a big part of who I am today.
And there are more than a few people in the NHL who have a similar story and a similar background that say the same thing. Kelly, I mentioned off the top of the success that you had with the Wheat Kings, and because of that success, NHL teams were interested in your services, but you stayed where you were. Why was that?
The timing, I think, just, you know, a couple of different times, it just, for me, didn't work out with where the Wheat King team was at and in their cycle, because junior hockey is a little bit cyclical, because, you know, players come in at 16 or 17 and then, graduate at 19 or 20. You know, the year I came to, Las Vegas was the summer of 2016. You know, I had some opportunities in the summer of 2015, but I thought that the Wheat Kings had a really good chance to win. They've been, you know, my whole life, my whole career. I didn't want to leave the team. And if the team didn't win, I didn't want to have that regret that I, you know, hadn't helped, you know, those players reach the championship level. So in 2016, the 15-16 season, we did win the WHL championship. You know, then the opportunity with Vegas came up, and it just the timing was right. I was really fascinated by expansion. I love building teams, which this is obviously what we've done here in Vegas. I had a lot of respect for George McPhee and his record as an executive in the game. You know, it was clear right from my early discussions with George that we had fantastic ownership with Bill Foley. And, yeah, it just was, you know, I thought going to be an opportunity that very few executives ever get, that opportunity to build a team from scratch, to hire pro-scouting staff, amateur scouting staff, your development team, your coaches, all of those people you have a hand in hiring. And, you know, as fascinating as I thought year one would be, which is the expansion year, you know, it was 100 times that. It was just an incredible learning experience, first of all, to know every NHL organization right from top to bottom as we prepared for expansion. It was strategic. It was hard work. It was, you know, great relationships developed with people in our organization as we became a team. And that part couldn't have been, you know, more fulfilling and more exciting than it was. And then, you know, on the ice, in I guess what I call year two, which outsiders would call year one, the inaugural season, you know, clearly it's gone considerably better than anybody would have expected an expansion team to do.
Kelly McCrimmon, my guest. Kelly, one last thought, if you don't mind, I'd love to ask you about your brother Brad. Hockey fans, of course, remember Brad. He died tragically in a plane crash in Russia in 2011. What was he like as a person, and what was it like for you, as close as you were, to see him go on and have the success that he had in the NHL?
Well, Brad was a year older than me, so he was, he was my hero growing up. Whether you think of it in those terms, I think as time goes on, you get a little more clarity just to what the people in your life mean. And he was a great hockey player. He was, he played Junior A in Prince Albert. He was a great player there. He played 3 years in Brandon with the Wheat Kings, where he was first-round draft choice. He had an 18-year career. He never played a game in the minors. He won a Stanley Cup. I always felt, and I even use this, with players in Brandon that I coached, there's a difference between playing professional hockey and being a professional. I always thought, Brad was all of that in terms of, just the responsibilities of giving back to people and remembering people. I thought that that was always really important to him. So, obviously, miss him a great deal, but tremendously proud of him as a person and as a pro player.
Glad we could talk about him, and thank you for sharing your thoughts, Kelly, on Brad. He is the GM of the Vegas Golden Knights, was named that position September 1st, 2019. They're in first place in the Pacific. You've got Dallas and Vegas August 3rd. Kelly McCrimmon, our guest. Kelly, thank you so much. Good to finally have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jim.
Man, that's the stuff, right? That is the good stuff right there. Premium Stapp. Top shelf Stapp. The kind of Scott Stapp that's only reserved for special occasions like opening day. And today, July 23rd, is MLB's opening day. Spring training part two. Training camp. Summer camp is over. There are going to be actual baseball games beginning today. And that means that as of right now, the Marlins are, in fact, still in first place in late July. And then somehow, in spite of itself, MLB is about to have a season or something like a season. Must be real. MLB could not have had a worse offseason. There were the cheating scandals. There was the commissioner tripping all over himself after the cheating scandals, the pandemic, the way the sport puked all over itself in response to the pandemic. But now we actually have baseball games, actual baseball games. A 60-game sprint, no less. I mean, like, if a regular 162-game season is like a slow death march, this has got to be like pouring a bag of granulated sugar right into your mouth, smashing a triple espresso, and then jumping off a cliff. Because this is going to be a mad dash to be one of the 10 teams to make the postseason this year. Or one of the 16 teams to make the postseason this year. Because according to MLB Network, the league is about to open up the season today, and they're still having conversations about possibly expanding the postseason. This postseason. In a shortened regular season. Hell yes. You do you, MLB. You do you, MLB. Most other leagues would do something like announce the number of playoff spots before the start of the season. But it seems like you want to announce it during the season. Better yet, why not just announce it in August or September? No, better, don't announce the number of playoff teams until after the playoff teams or the playoffs start. How weird is this season going to be? We don't know how many postseason teams there's going to be. One team, the Toronto Blue Jays, doesn't have a home, and the season is about to start. They don't know where they're playing. Canada will not let them play in Toronto. They thought maybe Buffalo. They thought possibly Charlotte. They thought they might be able to make it work in Pittsburgh, but the state of Pennsylvania blocked that. Now they're scrambling to see about playing in Baltimore. Effectively, they're homeless. Now, I know that's kind of a buzz term for a lot of you clones. Homeless. A buzz term or a bat signal for you to come in here with your bum smack. There are not too many things on this show that I do not allow. Bum smack is one of those things, though. I don't want to hear about the Blue Jays using pizza boxes as bases or baguettes as bats. They're a Major League Baseball team. They're not going to use meatballs as baseballs. They're not going to use refrigerator boxes for their clubhouse. Don't come in here with that stupidity. Keep the main thing the main thing. Focus on real things. I'll give you an example. You need something to focus on? Focus on this. Focus how important every game is going to be. how important every game is, and then focus on horniness. I'll address these topics in order. First off, the importance of every single game. A three-game losing streak in a 162-game season, for instance, it's not that big of a deal. But a three-game losing streak in a 60-game season could be the end of your season. A key player missing a week with a tweaked shoulder or an ankle or some other crazy baseball injury. It's not the end of the world typically, but it could be this year. And that's before we even get into what a positive COVID test would mean. Speaking of positive tests, will every player on every team follow the rules? That's a big question, right? I mean, who knows? As one player told Jeff Passan, quote, "All it takes is one guy for this thing to go sideways because testing itself isn't going to keep us healthy." It's a good point. It's not going to be the testing, though, that keeps people healthy. It's going to be following the rules and the protocols. There's a difference. The testing only tells you whether it's working or not. And there's something else that's going to keep this season going. And for that, I'm going to read a quote from a player to Passan. This player said to Passan, quote, "I honestly think that horny dudes on the road are what's going to bring this down." End quote. Notice that person didn't say, like, if families come in, the virus is so contagious, if a guy hits a bar. No, horny dudes on the road are going to wreck the season. It's an amazing quote. Again, that's not from an email to the show. That's not from some anonymous egg on Twitter. That's a Major League Baseball player saying that to one of the most respected journalists in the game. My biggest concern? Horny dudes on the road. Dudes who can't keep it in their pants on the road. If something like that brings this season to a grinding halt, it's probably going to be because dudes can't control their horny level.
I can't control my horny level.
You imagine the MLB season, which has been very slow to start, brought to an early and premature end by horny dudes. Just unadulterated horniness. Horn dogs.
I can't control my horny level.
Dudes getting their horn on the road and busting out of the protocol. And if horny dudes do bring this season down, it's not going to be the first thing that horny dudes have brought down. Not the first time they brought down something that people worked so hard to build. Horny dudes bringing down the MLB season would be just another thing in a long line of things that horny dudes have destroyed over the years. Horny dudes have left a long path of destruction in their wake. Horny dudes, actually, is one of the worst things that could ever happen. A professional sports season would be just another notch on the proverbial bedpost. And if that does happen, it'll be further proof of what we already know, that sex has been, continues to be, and always will be, the undisputed, unbeaten, untied champion of the world. Baseball players can talk all they want, and I've heard guys say this. Yeah, it's going to be hard, but we're going to follow the rules. We're going to follow the rules because we want to play. We're going to follow all the protocol because we want to get paid. We understand what's at stake. Yeah, I believe that. I believe they do want to play. I do believe they know what's at stake, and I do believe they want to get paid. I believe all of that. I just don't believe that those things are more important to every last one of those guys than getting their horn on.
I can't control my horny level.
Somebody will get after it on the road. Somebody will get COVID. Somebody will bring that back to their clubhouse, and then it will be passed around, and it's going to be an issue. And why? Because they could not control their horny level.
I can't control my horny level.
That's not me just looking to spit something hot out. That's not one of you clones saying, hey, Rome, you know it's going to bring it down, don't you? These dudes who can't control their horny level. That's a major leaguer telling that to Jeff Passan. And I tend to think he's right, whoever that anonymous major leaguer was. Are you fired up? Baseball's back. Actual baseball games this evening. We'll see. Chris Mannix. Chris, great to have you back. Chris, I want to talk boxing with you in a minute, but you are down in Orlando in the NBA bubble at the moment. So let me start right there. How is life treating you, and what has the bubble been like for you so far, Chris?
It's interesting, Jim. You know, you get here, and you immediately have to do a hard 7-day quarantine, which means you can't leave your room for a full week. But once you leave your room, it's really interesting to be a part of all this. I mean, you know, ordinarily for a reporter, like to go see a team practice, you've got to hop on a plane and stay in a hotel for a few days. You know, on day one, I bounced between Toronto and Portland and Boston and Indiana and got to see practices and talk to different people. So from a work experience, I think it's great. Now, I was at my first scrimmage on Wednesday afternoon and Wednesday evening. It's definitely different in lieu of fans. The NBA has put up giant screens around the floor covering three quarters of the courts. You know, it's eerily quiet at times when you're out there watching, and it's definitely different. But, you know, all signs are positive right now for the NBA in terms of being able to pull this off.
We're talking to Chris Mannix. All right, Chris, also earlier in the week, you got a firsthand look at Skinny Melo in person. How did he look to you, and what kind of thoughts do you have about Portland's chances in this situation?
You know, he looked great physically. I'm waiting to see how he looks on the floor and just how much of the small four position he can handle at this stage of his career. Now, Portland lost Trevor Ariza, who elected not to come down for family reasons. So Carmelo's going to get an opportunity here. I mean, he's going to get his redemption story chance to be a starter probably with this team and to play small forward, a position he's played for most of his career. And the Blazers, I mean, a lot of people are looking at the Blazers as potentially being that Cinderella team. I mean, not only, you know, are they, you know, uniquely talented with their backcourt, but they're getting their whole front court back. You've got Yusuf Nurkic coming back to play. He was done before the pandemic hit. Zach Collins coming back to play. He was done before the pandemic hit. I mean, I've talked to some people down here. I mean, the Lakers, you know, if the Blazers get into the playoffs, that's the team the Lakers don't want to face. I mean, Danny Green has come out and flat out said it, that the Lakers don't want to face that team. I mean, I wouldn't either. I mean, that's a team with the kind of explosive backcourt that can put up a lot of points on you, and a front court that can beat you up now, which they couldn't do before.
Right, especially as beaten down as the Lakers' backcourt is too. Chris Mannix is joining us. Chris, what about Victor Oladipo? For instance, the thinking was initially that he was going to be in Orlando, but he was going to sit out games. But then Nate McMillan announced that he was going to play in the scrimmages. So what is the latest with Oladipo?
Yeah, I think he's going to play. Now, Oladipo's desire not to play basically stemmed from the fact that the Pacers weren't a contender, and he was only 13 games removed from a leg injury that cost him an entire calendar year. So he didn't see much of an advantage to coming back and, you know, playing out the string and maybe a first round with that team, not with so much to lose going into next season. But as he's been down here, you know, people in Indiana have told me that, like, he's been an active participant in all practices, and kind of the bug has come back for him. I mean, he's a basketball player, and if he's down here, there's a part of him that just wants to play. Now, the other layer to this is money. The NBA, you know, they walk a fine line with all this, but they've made it clear that players who are deemed medically healthy, if they don't play, they don't get paid. And Oladipo would be forfeiting about $3 million. That's real money for anybody, including Victor Oladipo. So, you know, he hasn't really commented on how big a factor that is, but I would imagine that, you know, if he's on the fence about playing, the $3 million is probably going to push him onto the side of playing.
Chris Mannix talking about the reboot for the NBA. We're covering a lot of ground with him. Chris, what about Kemba Walker? He's been dealing with a knee injury going back to before the pandemic. What's your sense as to where he is right now in terms of health, and what would that mean to the Celtics?
Well, it's troubling because Kemba Walker had what was defined back in March as a nagging knee injury, and now 4 months later, it's still not healed. I mean, that certainly raised some red flags if you're in Boston. Now, they've been ramping him up pretty slowly in the practices out here. He's not going to play in today's scrimmage, but they're hopeful to get him in to the subsequent two. So, you know, they're cautiously optimistic that Kemba Walker will be out there on the floor, but this is, I mean, Kemba's everything to Boston. He is a huge part of what they do offensively. I mean, they were decent when he was out of the lineup, but, I mean, he goes out, they go from a team that, you know, has a chance to come out of the Eastern Conference to one that might get beat as early as the first round. So that's something they're watching, you know, really closely in Boston. I mean, I watched Kemba at a practice recently. He was running full speed and sprints up the floor. He was moving around pretty well, but obviously in game situations, there's still some lingering pain there. That's going to be one of the things that's going to be worth watching as this this regular season starts.
Yeah, so much good intel on that, and a lot of things I want to talk to you about, Chris. I'm going to pick my spots. What was it like, for instance, to be at the scrimmages yesterday without any fans? How would you describe that experience?
Strange, because when the players first run onto the floor, the PA announcer says, "Please welcome the Brooklyn Nets," and you're wondering who he's talking to. Like, there's only media that's sitting there and kind of a smattering of NBA personnel.
You, Chris, you're the one who's supposed to welcome the Nets or welcome the visiting Orlando Magic in Orlando.
Yeah, I mean, the Orlando Magic had some fans that were already there, but it's just, it was strange for sure. I mean, you know, when players got out there on the floor, the ones I talked to after the game, they felt it was pretty normal. Like, it's still basketball. It's done without fans, and there's a certain thing missing and all that, but they're basketball players, and most of these guys have played basketball, you know, in empty gyms a lot, you know, whether it's practice facilities or, you know, games in previous, you know, parts of their lives. But the biggest difference, Jim, from talking to different guys is that players are finding that they need to be more vocal on the bench during games. Usually the energy that teams pick up on the floor comes from the crowd, right? You know, the fans are behind them or they're against them, whichever way you're drawing energy from, that one way or the other. With no fans, players on the benches have taken it upon themselves to provide that energy. So when I was talking to Lou Williams, his voice was shot. And he was saying to me, like, you know, I've never lost my voice in a game before. That's because these guys are constantly yelling and chattering out there to support their team. That's going to be something that, you know, guys have to adjust to. They're just how involved they have to be when they're on the sidelines and not in the game.
All right, so really quickly, Chris, in terms of the news earlier today of a Tyson Roy Jones Jr. exhibition here in California in September, what is your reaction? For instance, do you think that the fight's going to happen? And if so, who's the audience? I mean, is this something that actual fight fans want to see?
I mean, there are so many layers to this, and this is something that I've been chasing for almost a month now, because I knew Tyson wanted to fight Roy Jones, and they have been, you know, basically having their hand out to, like, every country in the world trying to get them to put up the money to fight it. I mean, they were trolling through Saudi Arabia and the Middle East to try to get the money for a fight like that. They, you know, I got the press release today. They settled on Carson, California, probably the Dignity Health facility out there. And it's allegedly going to happen on July 12th. I just don't know where the money's coming from, Jim. Like, they're going to put this on pay-per-view. It's going to be on some kind of music streaming app called Trilla, which I've never heard of before today. But this is a lot of money these guys are going to want to get paid. And on top of that, there's plans to have a significant undercard. I mean, one fight that I reported on just about an hour ago was that Nate Robinson, the former NBA guard, is going to fight Jake Paul, the YouTuber that recently fought on DAZN last year. So, like, if that's happening, that's going to cost them some money. There's going to be a fighter named Badu Jack, who's a former world champion that's supposed to be on that card. I mean, you're talking, like, tens of millions of dollars in guarantees that you need to make. And I don't know how that money, that fight makes it back. Certainly not in California, where you're not going to be able to have fans in the stands. That takes one source of revenue off the table. And I don't know what it does on pay-per-view. I mean, would I watch Tyson Jones if it was free? Maybe, because I'm morbidly interested in something like that. But I'm certainly not paying $50 or $60 to go and see that. I mean, that's why I keep, on social media, I keep calling it this alleged fight, because I don't believe that they'll ultimately be able to pull it off, because the money will be so significant.
But again, to be fair, Chris, it's not just $50 for Tyson Jones. It's $50 for Tyson Jones and Jake Paul and Nate Robinson. Like, is that a real thing? Jake Paul against former NBA guard Nate Robinson?
Oh, it's a real thing. It's a real thing. And, you know, Nate Robinson wants it. Jake Paul's been into boxing a little bit over the last year or so. It's beyond stupid, but you know, it's a real thing.
All right, so really quickly, getting back to actual boxing tomorrow night, Virgil Ortiz is going to fight on DAZN. It's the start of the summer and fall of boxing on DAZN. You will not be on the call of this fight, but for those who do not know, how good is Ortiz and how bright is his future?
I think he's the best prospect in boxing, hands down. He was the consensus 2019 prospect of the year on everybody's list. He has won 15 fights in a row. If he's 15-0, won them all by knockout. Everything coming inside the sixth round. He is the real deal. Every time he steps up in competition, he looks even more impressive. And he's fighting at 147 pounds, Jim. That's a glamour weight class where the Pacquiao's are, the Errol Spence's are. He's not going to get a shot at them anytime soon, but I think we're looking at the next big thing in boxing. It's like when I watch him, I see what I saw with Spence and Danny Garcia and some of these other young American fighters that came out of the amateur ranks and started to build their careers early. He's the real deal. He is the next big thing in boxing, and he is television friendly. All his fights ended knockout, and I think this one, at some point, landed a knockout as well.
I was going to say, Chris, one last thought then. I mean, when you say everything the way you just said it, and you talk about him the way you just did, how important is it that he not only show up and win that fight, but win it a certain way, that he takes the fight directly to Vargas and he finishes him early? How important is that?
Yeah, I think it's big, because if you're fighting a guy like Vargas, who's solid, but every time he's stepped up in competition, he's lost, you kind of look at the fighters that Vargas has faced, right? Like, Vargas has faced Errol Spence and was knocked out. He faced Danny Garcia and was knocked out. In your mind, if you're Virgil Ortiz, you probably want to go into that fight knocking him out earlier and more spectacular. That's probably the only thing you can get out of a fight like this. I mean, Vargas is not in his class. He's eventually going to get stopped, I think. Doing it in a more spectacular fashion, I think, would be a feather in the cap for Virgil Ortiz.
We are joined by Sean Casey. Sean, talking to you on this day is one of my favorite traditions on the program. You and I always talk on opening day. In fact, it would not be opening day, Sean, if I was not talking to you. So I had to make sure we connected. But before we talk baseball, how are you and everybody around you doing as we go through this most unusual time, Sean?
Romy, first off, brother, great to be back on with you. It's opening day. I love coming on with you and hearing your voice. Man, it's just been crazy times. You know, I think it's been crazy for you and me and everybody, just uncharted territory. And, I think everybody a few months ago was like, oh, we just want normalcy back and all that. And, you know, I think the one good thing is, you know, baseball coming back tonight and, you know, even a 60-game season, you know, brings back a little sense of normalcy for everybody, that we can sit back and enjoy a Major League Baseball game and get away for a little bit.
You know, Sean, there's nothing normal about a 60-game season. I will get into that in a minute. You and I have talked about your family in the past and how athletic your family is. Your son, Andrew, graduated high school. He's going to play baseball at Dayton. And then last week, your son, Jake, committed to Kent State. What has it been like for you as a dad to watch them grow up the way they have?
Oh, bro, you're so good, man. You're so good. It's been great, man. I tell you what, like, you know, for me, being a dad, you know, I love baseball. You know, I love baseball because my dad loved baseball. And, you know, being able to pass it on to my kids, you know, they don't really remember me playing much. I think my last year in Boston, they were 6-5. And, you know, and I remember in the World Series, I remember homering in 2006 in the World Series. You look up, I think my one son Jake's pooping his diaper. My other son Andrew's drawing, you know, cartoons and stuff. So, you know, for me to have these last few years, like, hitting in the cages with them every day and seeing them become men, you know, Andrew going off to Dayton and Jake going off to committing to Kent State, you know, for me has just been awesome. And I told him, I said, hey, I'm going to probably get a condo out in Dayton and a condo at Kent State. You'll see me all the time.
That's
the
best.
You'll see me all the time. I'll be tailgating before the games, you know.
That's the best. Maybe not for them, but that's the best. That's the best if you're a dad. Sean Casey joining us. You know, those guys, they want a little bit of room. They want a little bit of space. As athletes, though, Sean, especially in baseball, there's a routine, right? It's a very regimented, routine-driven kind of off-season, spring training, than the regular season. This year has been so different in terms of all of that. Spring training, shutting it down, not knowing if there'd be a season or not, then having a summer camp. If you were playing right now, how would you approach the summer camp restart?
Well, that's a great point, because I remember coming in the big leagues and people would say the most important thing you need is to find a really good routine that you can do every day for a 162-game season. And, you know, the big leaguers are especially creatures of habit. So for these guys, you know, having to start, then stop, then come back, and all the COVID, you know, restrictions that they have, no fans, you know, just all the things, you know, social distancing in the clubhouse, you know, I think what they're going to have to find is, hey, listen, you know, this is a unique situation. I got to find a new routine that works. But I do think you will find guys going back to their game day routines, and that's why I think games will be so important for these guys, feeling like it matters when you get in the batter's box or on the mound, because now I can dial in. Now I can mentally get ready to play and know that the games matter and I can get a good routine. So it's definitely going to be a challenge for these guys, but they're the best in the business, especially mentally.
Well, I mean, Sean, the games matter, but they matter even more because there's so few games. Like, if you get off to a slow start in a normal season, it's not a problem because you know you have 162 games in that season. So as a hitter, what's the key to coming out as hot as you possibly can?
Well, that's a great point. You know, I think, Romy, for me as a hitter, I used to break it down in 100 at-bats, okay? How many hits, through 100 at-bats, I'd take a look. Then the next 100. You know, they don't have that luxury now. It's 2 months coming out the gates. And, you know, sometimes if you get off to that slow start, you know, I think you have to realize you can't put the premium on that you're going to get 600 at-bats. You got to look at it and say, okay, it could be 200-plus at-bats I'm going to get here. I got to make sure I do not waste a pitch. I got to be able to show up, have a good routine, mentally get ready for pitch number one, starting game one, and through 60 games, just lock in pitch by pitch and try and go from there. I mean, that's really all you can do because you don't have the luxury of, you know, of having that six-month routine.
Sean Casey joining us. Also, Sean, managers are not going to have the luxury that they're used to, and it's going to be really interesting to me to see how they handle their pitchers and their bullpens in a 60-game season. For instance, could you see some managers getting exposed because there will be so much scrutiny on everything they do in every single game?
Oh, Romy, I think this is a big part, you know, that people might be overlooking to say, hey, listen, when you come to postseason time, how many times do you see managers sometimes get exposed? The game gets too fast. They don't make the pitching change that they want to make, right? And so for 60 games, what's great is you've got everyone's in the dance, right? 30 teams are all in it. I mean, anyone can win it. And it's really going to show who are the good managers and who aren't. I think you're going to see sometimes managers that the game maybe moves too fast for them will get exposed, especially with the new bullpen rules of, you know, having to face three hitters and also too, like, having to mix and match guys. Are your starters going to go? Are you going to let them go 7, 8, 9 innings, or are you going to, you know, get them out of there in the 5th, 6th? And how do you use your bullpen? You know, if certain guys get hurt, how do you mix and match off your bench? It's going to be great for that. Like, I'm looking forward to seeing how the managers react in this 60-game sprint.
He is a former major leaguer. He is an analyst with MLB Network. He is Sean Casey. And Sean, you, of course, are one of the legendary storytellers. There is one from your first day in the bigs. For some reason, your equipment had not arrived in Cleveland, but you weren't expecting to play in the game, so you and the legend, Richie Sexson, were hanging out at the end of the bench, crushing sunflower seeds. Sean, for those who do not know, what happened next?
Oh, man, that's a great story, Romy. Well, we're in Chicago, you know, and Richie Sexson and I, you know, a couple other guys had just gotten called up. I'm sitting at the end of the bench, and I'm thinking, man, I just enjoy being here. Like, my dreams come true. Like, I'm in the big leagues, and obviously at the time, the 97 Indians are one of the best teams in the game. Tommy, Manny Ramirez, you know, go down the list of guys, Omar Vizquel, Oral Hershiser, you know, the Dave Justice, they're loaded. And I remember thinking, man, I just want to enjoy the game. I've had like 5 bags of sunflower seeds. My face is on fire from the Davy salt, like all over my mouth, you know. And next thing I know, in the 8th inning, here comes Johnny Gorrell, who was the bench coach at the time, and says, hey, Case, he said, hey, listen, if Dave Justice hits, you're going to hit for him. And I'm like, oh, I mean, talk about stomach. I thought I was going to throw up. I was like almost sick. And so I'm like, okay, yeah, no problem. So it starts to happen. Justice is about to get up. And as I go on deck, Romy, I realize, oh my God, my stuff never came from Buffalo. We just won the championship the couple days before, and our equipment never arrived. So I'm like, I have no bat, I have no and the big league helmets only have the one ear flap, right? So you're fired up to be in the big leagues. You know, in the minors, you have the double ear flap. So I go, oh my God. So I start scrambling. I'm going through the bat rack. I pull out a T-141, Manny Ramirez. I don't even know Manny. You know, first day there, I go to Manny. Hey, man, my equipment didn't come. Any chance I could use your bat? He's like, oh, no problem. Mi hermano, no problem. So I'm like, oh, yes. So I got Manny Ramirez's bat. I go through all the helmets. I need a 7.25 lefty. Tony Fernandez is a switch hitter. So I pull out a 7.25. I go to Tony. Tony, can I borrow your helmet? He's like, yeah, no problem. So I got Tony Fernandez's helmet on, Manny Ramirez's gloves, and Jeff Manto, who I'd come up with, and Mick Manto. I let up borrowed his batting gloves. I go up there for my first at-bat. My dad's in the crowd, you know, Big Jim Casey. I look up. He's standing up going nuts. Fans are probably in Chicago like, who's this maniac? He's excited. My mom's excited. I got 4 buddies from college that probably – one's wearing a green wig. It's going south anyhow. They're in the family section. I'm like, this is so bad. So anyway, I go up there. First at-bat, Romy. I'm facing this guy, Jeff Darwin. I get to 1-2. And, you know, talk about the game speeding up on you. I don't even remember those 3 pitches. I was just so excited, anxiety-ridden to be there. But I remember thinking, I cannot strike out my first at-bat. So I stepped out. I took a deep breath, slowed down for the first time. Darwin gave me a 1-2 slider. Bam, get a knock through the hole. I look over there. My mom and dad are going crazy, you know, and my buddies. And it was my first knock. And I remember thinking, if I don't get if I don't get another hit in the big leagues, I just realized my dream. I made the big leagues, got a hit, and, you know, it's all gravy from here on out.
That's absolutely incredible. What an amazing story. And you did all that without your own bat, batting gloves, and a helmet. Insane. Really quickly,
yeah,
Sean.
What ticked me off was Manny Ramirez, you know, the next day, he just grabs his bats and decides to tape them all. So I'm like, oh, my God. Which I wanted to have the bat I got my first hit with, but I looked and I was still so scared to ask him for any of those bats, so I never got that back because Manny ended up taping all the handles up. Something Manny being Manny.
I was just gonna say Manny being Manny. All right, so Case, what a great story. So you and Ryan Dempster are serving as guest DJs this week on Pearl Jam Radio. What kind of prep have you done for that, and what's going to be your approach when you're on the air there?
Oh man, well, you know what, Romy, we taped it last week, so Demp and I got together. And, you know, we sat down and we just put together our best, 10 to 12 songs that we really liked and stories that we've had over the years. And, we just sat down, got our songs all lined up and, kind of went through it. And, it was a great time. And I don't know, I'm sure you know Dempster, man, one of the best guys baseball's ever had personality-wise. So he and I getting a chance to host Pearl Jam Radio for the week was just really a really cool gig for us.
What a blast. Case, there's no way you come on the program and we don't talk about the Miracle League of the South Hills. First, I want to start with, how was the pandemic? How did the pandemic impact your plans with the Miracle League? What happened?
Yeah, appreciate it, Romy. Yeah, you know, Miracle League of the South Hills, you know, we kind of had to fall in line with everyone else. You know, our kids are, you know, very susceptible to, you know, a lot of the things, like this COVID-19. So, yeah, we had to shut down our summer season. I'm not sure about the fall season. But, you know, we have to get together as a board and figure that out. But, yeah, we've just tried to stay afloat and, figure out, you know, how to still impact our kids, maybe through Zoom. We've had coaches call in and had their teams call into Zoom and stuff. So we're figuring it out just like everyone else and every other charity out there is figuring out our business. So, we can't wait to get the kids back on the field and just get going again, man, because it's such a wonderful thing.
It's the best thing, Sean. And really quickly, the league has a campaign you have a campaign to raise money for the next phase of the league is what I mean. How exciting is that particular phase, and what's that going to mean for the athletes and their families?
Yeah, man. What we're trying to do is we're trying to build a concession stand that we're going to use as a job training facility for our kids. So what we're going to do is we're going to bring our kids that are special needs, come in. We're going to have our Tim Gephardt, who's our president, who helps, president of operations. He's going to sit down, put them through a job interview, have them fill out an application, and just like they would have a job. And then we're going to partner with other companies in the Pittsburgh area, and we're going to train our kids at our facility and then have them go out and get jobs in around Pittsburgh. It's a great idea, and like I said, we're looking to raise some money now, you know, get that done, and hopefully when this COVID-19 stuff, runs its course at some point, we'll be back to that fundraising.
That is such a good idea. He is the president of the board of the Miracle League of the South Hills. Also, remember to watch Sean as part of MLB Network's wall-to-wall opening day coverage, including live games every day, beginning with tomorrow's Tigers and Reds game. Sean, we did it again. It's opening day. You and I had to come together. Great to hear your voice. Great to get another Casey story, and have a great time with it, Sean.
All right, Robbie, thanks, dude. Happy opening day, my man, and I will talk to you soon, brother.
Good night now!